This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The time is 5 o'clock, roughly 2 minutes past 5 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Mon Key, presenting Tony Bennett in concert this June at Edgefield. Tony Bennett tickets available this Friday. Also presenting Steve Miller and Pink Martini and more this summer. Tickets and info at edgefieldconcerts.com. And now, coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon House of Representatives votes yes for the Columbia River crossing.
Two Oregon activists may be released from custody after serving months in prison for refusing to testify before a grand jury.
And the United Nations says it will not compensate victims of a cholera epidemic in Haiti that killed 8,000 people and was linked to foreign soldiers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 25th, 2013. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen.
House Bill 2800A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed.
The Oregon State House of Representatives passed a bill this morning to fund the Interstate 5 Columbia River Bridge Replacement Project, known as the Columbia River Crossing. House Bill 2800 was passed with a 45-11 vote and will now head to the Senate. The bill caps the total construction costs at $3.4 billion and limits the amount Oregon can borrow to $450 million. Washington State is supposed to match Oregon's funding, and the balance will come from the federal government and tolling revenues. Oregon Department of Transportation officials say that federal funds will cover the project through 2015, after that additional funding would be needed. This will have to come from reallocating money from other highway projects, since the bill does not include an increase in revenue. Dan Smith with the Service Employees International Union found that in an interview with KBOO Today that other projects with the Oregon Department of Transportation have been problematic for a number of reasons.
Absolutely. One of the things that we are very aware of is that the state of Oregon is working to privatize much of the work that is done by state workers. More and more work that used to be done entirely by state workers is being contracted out to corporations within and outside of Oregon. What this has done is it has caused a number of cost overruns. Oregon being a state where the lowest bid takes the contract, we very often see that these corporations are bidding low and then submitting cost overruns after the time of the contract. We're also seeing, especially in ODOT, some tremendous mistakes being made. There was a highway bridge on 217 that was built to a low bidder, an out-of-state corporation. And then when the bridge was inspected, after it was completed, it was found that they had not done a geological survey of the area and that the bridge had not been appropriately anchored into the hillside. And so this being Oregon, it rains, the soil gets wet, and it slides. And that made that highway bridge unsafe. We have grave concerns about this process and about who is or is not selected to do the work. As I was saying about the 217 bridge project, that bridge had to be destroyed and then the debris removed by state workers. If the bridge had been built initially by state workers, I believe it would have been built correctly and without the problems. My concern is for the Columbia River crossing that something similar would happen, that a corporation who is unfamiliar with Oregon would either not do the necessary work to build the bridge safely, or that in doing so, they would have tremendous cost overruns. There are a number of instances where these corporations come back, and it's because of these kind of things that SEIU is directly taking on the contracting out of state services.
Cliff Vance, representing District 60, explains in today's hearing about how Oregon's share of the cost will come from current federal funding called Moving Ahead for Progress, or MAP funds.
The identified source to fund a $450 million bond is the $480 million that the state of Oregon currently receives in the form of formula funding from the federal government, commonly referred to as MAP funds. The annual cost to Oregon for this $450 million is anticipated to be $28.5 million per year. This means that from the annual formula payment of $480 million, we would take about 5.9% to pay the debt service on the $450 million.
What's not clear is what projects the $30 million per year will be taken from. Representative Lou Frederick from House District 43 said he was concerned about the jobs being put at risk if a bridge is built too low for barges and shipping vessels to pass under it. He is also alarmed that the Coast Guard's objections to the bridge are still unanswered. This will be covered by one of five conditions or triggers outlined in the bill that must be satisfied before the state of Oregon can issue the $450 million in bonds.
And I want to remind you briefly of the triggers that are in this bill. No bonds are authorized without the triggers we've included. Our friends in Washington must authorize a matching financial contribution. The Coast Guard must issue a bridge permit. The state treasurer must approve investment grade analyses and the finance plan. And the federal government must commit to a full funding grant agreement.
Another condition raised by Representative Frederick is the health implications in other neighborhoods that it would be affected by the increased traffic throughout North Portland. The bill does not require studies and recommendations for creating a fund, does require studies for air quality and other public health concerns, but Representative Frederick is not concerned this is enough and said he would be voting no.
Colleagues, I rise to speak because I remain disturbed about this project, and I plan to vote no. My district is bounded on the south and the west by freeways. People in my district bear a heavy burden from these freeways that benefit the rest of the state. Neighborhoods in my district were raised over 50 years ago to make way for I-5. Since they've been in operation, the remaining neighborhoods have been subject to high pollution levels. We have the highest asthma rate in the state. I have yet to see a plan that really addresses the potential for this project to increase rather than mitigate congestion near the Rose Quarter. Undertaking a project of this size to move congestion south a couple of miles doesn't help.
The bill passed the Oregon House after today's vote and is now headed to the Senate.
The Hanford nuclear site near Richland, Washington, is currently leaking radioactive waste and threatening the area's groundwater. Hanford Nuclear Reservation produced plutonium originally during World War II as part of the Manhattan Project. Plutonium produced at Hanford was used in the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. Washington Governor Jay Inslee announced Friday that six underground storage tanks were leaking, information that contradicted the U.S. Energy Department's report last week that said that only one tank was damaged, leaking an average of 150 to 300 gallons per year. The Energy Department issued a brief statement acknowledging the new information and stating that they still believe there is no immediate public health risk. Hanford is the most contaminated nuclear dump in this hemisphere. Previous leakage of nuclear waste has caused soil and water contamination, and these new leaks are furthering the existing problems. KABU will continue to follow this story as it develops.
The trial to determine damage owed by BP and other corporations to pay for the nation's worst oil spill began today. Jim Royce, the attorney representing individuals and other businesses affected by the 2010 oil spill, which contaminated a large area in the Gulf of Mexico, spilling millions of gallons of oil. Presiding over the trials is U.S. District Judge Carl Barbier. The trial is expected to last several months, but Judge Barbier has publicly stated he will not allow the trial process to stretch into years. Opening statements will be heard today, and the first witnesses will take the stand tomorrow. BP and Transocean Ltd. are both facing accusations of gross negligence. Under the Clean Water Act, companies found negligent pay higher fines per gallon of pollutants spilled. Attorney Jim Roy alleges the companies did not properly train employees and that workers didn't understand the risks they faced their jobs. Roy further alleges that proper safety protocols were both ignored and focus was instead placed on a speedy conclusion to the project because it had gone $50 million over budget. The explosion immediately prior to the oil spill killed 11 workers. The trial will be held in two parts with different goals. The first is to determine the exact cause of the spill and assign responsibility to the corporations involved. The second phase will address the efforts to stop the spill and exactly how much oil was released into the Gulf.
A British energy corporation is suing a group of protesters for profits they allegedly lost while the protesters shut down their power plant. The protest took place last October when 21 protesters were arrested for blocking chimneys at the gas-powered electric plant in West Burton, England. The activist group No Dash for Gas argues that decarbonizing the electricity system, which produces 30% of greenhouse gas emissions in England, is the most cost-effective way to transition to a carbon-neutral economy. They say that natural gas is not much cleaner than coal and question the so-called Dash for Gas promoted by British politicians. Now, the energy company EDF is suing the protesters for £5 million British pounds. This includes both the profits the company lost during the time the plant was shut down and the cost of private security and so-called incident managers hired by the company to have the protesters removed. According to the protesters, this case sets a dangerous precedent. They say it could have a chilling effect on future protests and also point out the possibly illegal collusion between the EDF Corporation and British police. Activist Hannah Davies spoke with HuffPost Live about the issue.
One of the most concerning things about this is that the police seem to have been talking directly with EDF, actually helping them to sue us. When I was sitting in the custody suite, my lawyer was speaking with the custody sergeant about my bail conditions. And during a kind of lull in that conversation, a police officer served him with the papers from EDF. He was quite surprised. He looked shocked by this because obviously this isn't something that usually happens. It usually happens from the company to the person that they're suing. It doesn't normally come via the police. And other people have been served directly by the police. Someone was leaving the police custody, having been held probably for about 12 hours, having been up a chimney for several days, very tired. He chased him down the road and said, "Oh, I forgot to give you this. I'm doing this as a favour to EDF." The police obviously take names and addresses when they arrest people. There's no way that EDF could have that information. The police sometimes make mistakes when they write things down. And the fact that EDF have served papers on people that have got the same spelling mistakes that are on the kind of police documentation that we've received, it proves that the police have been directly communicating with EDF and handing them our personal information. I mean, that just brings up questions of data protection. I don't think this is about the money. I think this is more about intimidating us, trying to put us off, trying to frighten us, trying to frighten other people from taking direct action. Perhaps because EDF knows that the only thing that can make change happen at the moment, the way things currently are, seems to be direct action. So it's in their interest to put people off doing it. And we think that's why they are doing it. We don't really think they need, you know, £5 million for them is nothing.
We undertook a protest action. That was British activist Hannah Davies speaking about how she and 20 other activists are being sued by the British energy company EDF for a protest action last October that shut down a power plant for 5 days.
The Oregon branch of the Service Employees International Union has begun its bargaining session with the state for contract renewals of 55,000 public workers. In addition to the expected negotiations on pay rates, health care, and child care for the workers, the union is also demanding that the state make action against big banks and corporations. Dan Smith is a member of the union bargaining team.
SEIU and other unions have always supported the middle class in America and have worked to increase the standard of living for women and men, both in the work that they do and in their working conditions. We are essentially carrying this forward and saying that because these large corporations have gotten away with damaging our economy, that they should be held accountable, just as workers are held accountable for their work product. we're asking that the state essentially act on behalf of all middle-class men and women, and that they hold these corporate entities accountable. The idea being that our wages are affected by the relationships these corporations have with the government and with individuals throughout the state. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of men and women in Oregon who have sought to renegotiate their mortgages to get more favorable lending rates, and banks and other financial institutions have not been agreeable to that process. And we would like to see the state hold these people accountable, because our members and men and women throughout Oregon are being affected by this. We're not seeing action being taken by the state in any kind of rapid way in response to this, and we are trying to say everybody deserves to be treated fairly financially and otherwise. At every bargaining table, we are pushing for protection for the middle class, for, again, women and men who are working very hard to survive in a very tough economy. And we believe that everybody in Oregon should have a reasonable retirement. Everybody in Oregon should have health care. We would like to see that expanded so that everyone is covered. There's only so much of this we can do in our contract, but we are opening the door. We are trying to, at the very least, force the discussion within the legislature and with the governor's office that banks and corporations need to be held accountable for their actions.
That was Dan Smith of the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. The union hopes that by demanding accountability for big banks during their contract negotiations, they will pave the way for other unions to do the same. They say that this will change the discourse away from austerity measures to addressing the manufactured inequality which exists across the U.S.
Early this morning, Portland Jobs with Justice delivered a letter addressed to the Portland Business Alliance's chief executive, Sandra McDonough, before the noon rally at City Hall. The group of speakers included Portland Commissioner Amanda Fritz, who urged those gathered to attend the public hearing about earned sick days next Thursday, March 7th at 3 p.m. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Steve Hughes about the rally.
First, I wonder if you could tell us about what is the purpose of today's rally.
The purpose of today's rally is to really make sure that we move to a vote on this proposed ordinance as quickly as possible. We've been working on this effort to win earned sick days for all working people in the city of Portland for over a year now, and we're very close to a vote in city council, and we just want to make sure that moves forward, despite some attempts by opposition to delay action on this bill.
Can you tell us about the issue? I understand that the employees who have been denied sick leave up to this point include restaurant workers, so we could potentially be going into restaurants and being served by people who are ill?
Absolutely. Right now, the statistics paint a pretty grim picture. 80% of people working in the service industry don't have access to even one sick day when they or a family member is ill, which means you have a lot of people, in the restaurant industry in particular, going to work sick and exposing others to whatever they decided to come to work with that day. So it's a real public health issue. It's one that 145 other countries have already recognized as a critical issue and have passed national legislation. So we're really behind in terms of passing similar protections here for workers and for the public health, and we hope to change that at least in the city of Portland and hopefully at the statewide level as well.
And what's the status of the measure? I understand there was scheduled to be a hearing this Wednesday, and that's been delayed.
It's been delayed. It's more for administrative reasons, as far as we could tell. The main thing is the opponents of this are calling for more process. They're saying this hasn't been fully vetted. We need to wait and take a closer look at this. And we all know where that leads. It's just a delaying tactic. We've been at this a year already and more. We've had stakeholder meetings upon stakeholder meetings. And we have a solid policy that in many ways represents a compromise. Not everybody got, and everybody did not get what they wanted in this, including advocates for sick days. But the fact is we have a good starter proposal that's ready to be voted on, and the time for delay is past. We need to see this voted right away.
And who is opposed to the measure?
The most vocal opposition has come from Portland Business Alliance, but other business associations as well. Of course, the Oregonian editorial page has not been friendly to it. So, you know, I guess you could say the opposition hasn't come from unsurprising or from surprising corners. It's been pretty predictable, and the arguments they make are pretty predictable, that this will kill jobs, which is in complete opposition to the actual facts of the matter, because this is past already in both Seattle and San Francisco, and also the state of Connecticut, actually. And in all cases, there is no data to show employment has shrunk, and in fact, it's increased in most of those locations, even after sick days has passed. So it's not, we don't see a correlation there, and I don't think the commissioners are buying that. It's been good. We've had a good group of people. We had Jobs with Justice here. We had Working America here. We had Working Families here, of course, Family Forward Oregon, who's been a real leader on this campaign, all there. We had Commissioner Amanda Fritz spoke to the crowd, as did Commissioner Dan Saltzman's Chief of Staff, both thanking us for being here and saying that they were confident and happy with the process that brought us here and looking forward to a vote. So we feel very good about it.
Thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Steve Hughes from the Working Families Party.
Thanks for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Tonight's show looks into the Big Brothers, Big Sisters Second Chance program. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly sunny throughout the day, with highs near 50 degrees. There's a slight chance of rain later in the evening. Otherwise, Tuesday should see a mostly cloudy night sky. Lows around 41.
It is 5:25 and time for our daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When President Obama called for raising America's wage floor to $9 an hour, GOP House Leader John Boehner attacked it like a gator on a poodle. Incredibly, he claimed that raising the wages of our country's most poorly paid workers would hurt, guess who? America's most poorly paid workers. This disingenuous pitting of poor people against themselves is derived from a corporate-manufactured myth that hiking the minimum forces small business owners to fire employees or even go bankrupt. When you raise the price of employment, he grumped, guess what happens? You get less of it. Well, guess again, John. That job killer fable has been debunked again and again by real-world experience. The pay floor has constantly been elevated by Congress, states, and cities, causing little to zero negative impacts on job numbers, but very positive results for employee morale, productivity, and turnover. It also generates a spending boost for local economies, especially for, guess who, small businesses. Obviously, the major impact of the raise is to lift the incomes of about 18 million hardworking people in low-wage jobs, allowing them to make a down payment on a used car or enroll in a couple of community college classes. Plus, it gives at least a token nod to the essential need of bridging America's dangerously widening chasm of economic inequality. This is Jim Hightower saying, the real shame in the Republican leader's attack is not his flagrant dishonesty, but the raw disdain it flings at low-wage workers, 60% of whom are women. The Boehners, Romneys, Koch brothers, and Wall Street billionaires see such people only in terms of their price tags, not in their value. That dehumanized contempt for the working class not only stains those who look down on the non-rich, but it's also holding back public policies to help America reach its full economic potential. And it is social dynamite.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Two people jailed in federal custody in Seattle for their refusal to testify before a grand jury will have a hearing Friday to determine if they go free. Matthew Duran and K.T. Olechnik have been imprisoned since last year for their refusal to testify before the prosecution. Duran has been jailed since September 14th and Olechnik since September 28th. Their lawyers filed a motion for them to be released, saying that their incarceration meant to coerce them into giving testimony is instead punitive in nature. Duran, Olechnik, and fellow resistor Maddie Pfeiffer are all being held in civil contempt. The three have been held in solitary confinement since late December. Members of the grand jury, the proceedings of which are secret, are thought to be investigating vandalism, which occurred in Seattle on May 1st of last year, as part of the May Day protests. Recently unsealed documents show that the FBI was surveilling a group of unidentified Portland anarchists, identified to them by Portland police, who the government thinks participated in property destruction at the Nakamura Federal Courthouse. It is unknown if this is the sole focus of the grand jury. Supporters of the resistors say that the grand jury process is akin to political repression and that the government is using the process to glean information about radical communities in the Northwest. The hearing will be held on Friday, March 1st, in downtown Seattle.
The Oregon House Judiciary Committee will hear testimony tomorrow on whether to sponsor a referendum asking voters to repeal the death penalty. Capital punishment has been halted in Oregon since 2011, when Governor John Kitzhaber decreed a moratorium on executions. If House lawmakers agree to sponsor the measure, it would be one step closer to appearing on the 2014 ballot as a state constitutional amendment. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with Jeffrey Ellis of the Oregon Capital Resource Center, which provides support to lawyers defending death penalty cases, about the hearing tomorrow.
Can you give us a little background about what the lawmakers in the House Judiciary Committee are going to be hearing?
So there's what's called a joint resolution that refers to the people a vote on abolishing or keeping the death penalty in place. Oregon's death penalty is in our Constitution, so unlike other jurisdictions that, for instance, could abolish the death penalty through a legislative enactment, in Oregon, the people need to vote on the death penalty. And so House Joint Resolution number 1 asks that the legislature refer the matter to the people for a vote in the next general election, which would be 2014.
There might not be enough popular support to pass that in 2014. What is your opinion on that?
I personally feel that if the issue went up to a vote in 2014, that Oregonians would replace the death penalty with life without parole. However, 2014 is not a presidential election year, and we know from past presidential election years that a much larger group of people turn out in presidential elections. And so one could make a colorable argument that perhaps 2016 is the better year to put this on the ballot.
Can you talk a little bit about Gary Hagen, who he is, and how his case is proceeding and how this may affect the debate?
Well, Gary Hagen is an individual who has been sentenced to death. During the progress of his case, he indicated that he wished to give up his appeals and be executed. And in response to that, the governor declared a moratorium on executions, granting a reprieve of Mr. Haugen's execution, as well as anybody else who might have an execution date. The governor did so, asking Oregonians to engage in a discussion and ultimately a vote on whether they wanted to keep the death penalty in place. Mr. Haugen, since that period of time, has challenged the governor's action and has argued that he must accept the reprieve in order for it to be official or have force. And a judge agreed with him, and that issue is now in front of the Oregon Supreme Court, set for argument later in the spring of this year. If the Oregon Supreme Court decides that the reprieve was constitutional and that a governor has complete authority to give reprieves, to issue moratoriums on executions without acceptance, then the moratorium would stay in place. If, on the other hand, the Oregon Supreme Court agreed with Mr. Haugen, then the moratorium would be dissolved, and executions would proceed as long as the death penalty remains on the books in Oregon.
Georgia is trying to expedite their executions because their state supply of lethal injection drugs is about to run out. Can you talk about where Oregon gets their lethal injection drugs?
Well, we actually tried very hard to find where Oregon got its lethal injection drugs prior to the moratorium being declared. We know that when the moratorium was declared, Oregon was then interested in selling its drugs to other states who might be willing to use them. I have to say it's all a bit of clandestine drug dealing that is done by government officials. I mean, there really are attempts to buy drugs from nefarious characters or labs and use them for state-sanctioned homicide. It's an ugly business, frankly, and one that we should get out of. I'll be in Salem tomorrow, and I will be testifying in support of the joint resolution.
All right. Well, thank you for your time.
All right.
That was KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaking with Jeffrey Ellis about the future of the death penalty in Oregon.
Over the last week, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post have all reported that they've been experiencing an ongoing attack on their servers by Chinese hackers. These announcements were followed by an in-depth report by cybersecurity firm Mandiant, presenting evidence that these and hundreds of other cybersecurity breaches were carried out by the Chinese government. Tim Morer is a cybersecurity analyst with the Open Technology Institute. He argues that this type of attack is nothing new, and that the U.S. has engaged in the same activity. But this doesn't mean that Congress should use the report as an excuse to erode online privacy of U.S. citizens.
We already saw the executive order that the White House announced, I believe, 2 weeks ago, that tries to strengthen critical infrastructure.